From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. First one for 2015 with all of us here.
Yeah.
Thanks to Hunter and John for last week's one about David Carradine. Very enjoyable. And got John here. Hi, John.
Hello.
Okay. And Hunter as well. What's going on, Hunter?
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And, as you can tell as well, got a new intro to the show. The same music by DJ Paul Nice, but a different voice. A more professional-sounding voice than... John's is pretty professional when he did it for last year's one, but mine was fucking awful. It was horrible at the...
Remember, I suggested she do the intro.
That's right. So, Miss Leslie is the announcer now for this show, for the intros and the outros. And just a thing as well, we've got a bit of a new system here that we are going to be running. Apart obviously from last week's one that you heard with about David Carradine, where it was just Hunter and John, we're going to have, what did you call them, Hunter? Ranch hands.
Yeah, there's the Cowboys, there's the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yep.
Me, John, and Stu. And
who's
make
what?
Make that order what you will.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Open to interpretation.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking of, like, we have regulars on the show. People who come on regular, Garrow, you know, Leslie, Andrew Farmer, who recently he and I are going to be doing more stuff together on this feed.
Good.
You know, and I thought that they would be like ranch hands. They're like our dude ranch people.
Yeah.
They come in and help us wrangle up podcasts.
Yep.
To use really lame marketing terminology. You know, I just thought it would be cool to have more people present that are sort of regular to regularly appear on the show.
Yep. So the ones
but,
that we have
one
chosen...
one of us will always be there. There will always be an anchoring presence.
That's right. So if one of us or two of us away, these guys will and girls will step in and help out. The four that we've selected that will be our ranch hands, if you will, are in no particular order, Garrow, Leslie, Andy Farmer, and Defend Wall Street, Billy O'Keefe as well. Is the other one? Is the fourth. So, and Bill really spices up conversations. For the three of you that heard the episode that we did, that was just shoved onto the website, not on the feed or Stitch or anything. The one that Bill and I did, the very dry one that we did about... Charlie Hebdo and Black Lives Matter and Tommy Wiseau's The Room and shit. You'll know exactly what you're getting with that.
Yeah, you can't hear it anywhere else but our website, MidnightMovieCowboys.com.
You can't. You know what I noticed as well? You cannot even download it.
You can't?
There's no download option, so you have to play it off the site and stream it there.
And all right, so if you're bored at work, go to the site and just stream it.
And if you really want to download it, you're going to have to get a program like Audio Hijack Pro if you're a Mac user, stream it and copy it or record it while you're listening to it. It's the only fucking way you're going to get it.
Yeah.
Banned in 97 countries, like Cannibal Apocalypse.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we had one complaint.
So one if you're complaint. A fan of like episodes with Garrow, Super Mexican, Les, any of that stuff, you know...
Anything offensive, I think you're saying.
Anything offensive, go to MidnightMovieCowboys.com and listen to the Je suis MMC episode.
That's right, a.k.a. French Fried. It's up the top there next
French
to...
French Fried!
Website exclusive, yeah.
Yep. It's up there, up the top, above the latest episode. Next to it will be The World According to Arnold.
Say, man, The World According to Arnold. Hey, man!
Shit, I haven't got my rock in my glass here to do the eye.
Oh!
I don't have it at the moment. What a bummer.
Poor Sammy's glass eye.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, back for 2015. Really looking forward to this year. We've got some good stuff lined up for you. And we actually know what the hell we're doing with ourselves a few weeks in advance. How long that lasts, we don't know. But we'll keep...
We're planning in advance, but you know, by the end of next year, we're going to be like, "Look, guys, we need to plan in advance."
Yeah.
If we fish on the Facebook group for ideas, then you know we're winging it. We've lost our train.
We've lost our train.
We fell off the rail.
Yeah.
We've lost our podcast mojo. Yeah.
Speaking of 2015, anybody here? Speaking of January 2015, anybody here seen American Sniper yet?
No.
No. Not no. Sure. Might watch it.
Won't watch it.
Nope.
Okay.
No.
John, are you planning to see it?
Eventually. I'm not in a rush. I mean, every screening is like selling out, and I just don't have time to go to movies that much.
Mr. Clint fanboy over here. Okay. All right. Well, let's move on to a different topic, because this is not going to work.
No.
No. Different topic.
All right. Let's push hell on. Paper Planes. That was a good fun movie I saw the other day with the kids. Rated G effort with no swearing, no sex, no violence, no nothing in it. Good fun movie, actually. Really highly recommend it. When it hits other countries, I don't know. But for those of you in Australia, like me, it is worth your time. Whether you have children or not, nephews, nieces, it doesn't matter. Go out and watch it. Support the local industry, because this is a great movie by a good filmmaker as well. Robert Connolly, who's done... films like The Bank and the other one I've forgotten about. Three.
Animal Kingdom.
Oh, was that him, was it? It possibly was.
No.
No, that was somebody else, you jackass.
I was just throwing out a violent Australian movie.
Yeah, no. No, he did The Bank and he did a couple of those. Three Coins, I think, was one of his other ones as well.
The Proposition.
You love that movie. What is it about this film, The Proposition? Because it's got Nick Cave.
I don't know. I just like the sort of mystical Western element of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, yeah. I like the Nick Cave music paired with the like sort of desolate landscape. It's just something about it just like works for me. I don't know.
Know Nick Cave was a very, very fucking, I wouldn't say middle class, more like an upper class private school boy, don't you?
I don't know.
He's not the despondent, loner that he makes out. He's far from it. It's all.
Oh
act.
No! Well, that's the way a lot of musicians are. Is they create a persona it's like Lemmy talked about the Rolling Stones. You know, everybody thought that they were the hard men, but they were like art school, like pampered art school kids. Like he said, the Beatles were from the streets, but you would never know it because they dressed in. And
exactly,
you know, saying about love and stuff, but you know, but at the same time, you know, John Lennon like was kind of a violent asshole, you know.
Yeah,
yeah.
Which is why that the whole peace thing was a "Doth protest too much" thing.
Oh, totally, yeah. And the whole 7 days in bed, you shit in bed and kick it out with your foot, sort of. That was a little joke. That was.
Yeah, I mean, it was all like, he apparently had problems hitting women that he was in relationships with and stuff.
Oh, yeah, he was a total woman beater.
Was he?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Looks like Mark David Chapman put an end to that, didn't he?
Apparently.
Mark David Chapman saw him being mean to Yoko, and he was like, "Hey, we don't do that." Bang.
I mean, she's like a Japanese animatronic, bloody squealing idiot.
Did you see what's that big Scottish music festival that Metallica headlined last year? I don't know. It's a massive music festival.
Glastonbury, is it?
Glastonbury, that's it.
Yeah.
And there was footage of Yoko Ono playing at Glastonbury, and it went viral just based on how horrible it was. Like people were like, even people who would be predisposed to like worship that kind of like Yoko and her image were just like, why do we think this is good?
Those Beatle boys, they couldn't pick a wife for shit. I mean, music is based on musical talent. Lennon with Yoko,
for Ringo.
Yeah, Ringo.
I'm talking about based on musical talent. I mean, Linda McCartney. I've heard that isolated track of hers from that live show of Wings and. Yeah, it sounds like a dog barking into a microphone.
At least she and Paul were together until she died.
Yeah, that's right.
You know?
Yeah.
And then there's Heather Mills, that one-legged freak. You know?
Easy access fuck. That's all she was.
Oh, jeez. And, like, remember when you couldn't go online, open a newspaper without seeing stuff about her? And I remember Ringo and Paul were being interviewed by Larry King, and Larry tried to approach the subject of Heather Mills with Paul McCartney, and Paul was just like, yeah, I don't like to talk about it, so I don't.
Well, yeah, but when they were married, he's like, eh, she's only got one leg, man.
Oh, and I remember when I saw him on the Back in the USA tour.
She's only got one leg?
Yes. I remember I saw him on the Back in the USA tour, and he wanted to point out that his new girl, Heather, was in the front row and all that.
She's in the front row. She's only got the one leg, man.
She's got the one leg.
You can see her. She's the one hopping around.
My wife.
I want a bit of nookie tonight. If not, I'm going to put a flamethrower to your fucking plastic leg. So use it or lose it.
It's real easy. So doggy style, mate.
Hey, look, stump sex. This is something new, isn't it? We should make a video, Heather. Oh, God. That's not good. She's probably going to hear this. She's going to get so upset. She's going to hack her other leg off. Okay.
She's our one-legged MMC fan.
She was planning on reaching out to...
Actually, she'd be very handy in the film we discuss next.
I don't know what I mean, because I know we do have some physically disabled listeners.
So oh, Christ, yeah. No, don't do it.
We think we're like the savior, you know?
No. We don't make fun of disabilities, but Heather Mills, she...
Yeah, Heather Mills.
I won't say she ran her course, because that's a cruel term.
She had one leg.
It was.
That sounds, John. I tell you what. If you ever fucking redub the entire Yellow Submarine film, it'll be more enjoyable than the actual Yellow Submarine film.
I think, you know, it was funny. I saw they reissued a lot of the Beatles stuff on mono, and
I've got them.
And I saw the Revolver sitting there, and I picked it up, and I went, "Oh, Revolver!" And I looked on the back, and I saw the song "Yellow Submarine," and I went, "I don't think I want this one."
You're mad. Oh, you idiot. Oh, yeah.
It's a good record, but like, I hate that song so much. I was just like, there's another song, another album that doesn't have Yellow Submarine.
Hey, you can pick the needle up, and you can, there's a little thing you can pick the needle
that's
up and
true,
skip it, you know?
But I went with Rubber Soul instead.
Oh, that's all right. That's
there's not a bad cut on that one.
I've got them. I've got those in FLAC.
Although Abbey Road, I think, is really underrated as possibly their best record.
I did think that. I think the last three or four tracks, that long medley with, what was it? He's So Heavy, She's So Heavy, or, what's that last three or four tracks they meld together? It's got The End, Carry That Way.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
The problem is sometimes American editions are sequenced differently than what you might have.
This one's right. I'm just drawing a blank, that's all. Yeah, it's got Carry That Way, The End. And a few other things. It's like a big medley at the end. That's really good. The rest of the album, it's got some good stuff, like Maxwell's... Is Maxwell's Silver Hammer on that? It is, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe it is.
Yeah, that is. A whole bunch of them. Okay. Octopus's Garden I like as well.
But I found the songs grew on me. Like, it wasn't like, first time, it's great. But it's like, you know, fourth or fifth listen.
I've always hated listening to Come Together. I think it's the most gross fucking song I've ever heard.
Yeah,
I prefer the Aerosmith version.
Me too.
I hate the lyrics. It sounds like a Bukkake.
Mojo finger.
Come together.
I liked it though because where I grew up, you know, when I was a kid, we did not have a rock station. Mm. So if that played, that was like the heaviest thing you heard on that station. Because everything else was Michael Jackson and REO Speedwagon. So it was like.
If
they played Come Together, I was like, okay, cool. You know, this is the heaviest thing I'll hear all weekend.
I've been actually getting to a lot of Slayer again lately.
Are you serious?
Really?
Yeah, actually, I have been, yeah.
Oh, no, you hate Rain and Blood.
Yeah, I've got that. I got these, somehow. And I got the whole Slayer discography. And yeah, just like there's some of the stuff I really like. I like Show No Mercy. I really like Hell Awaits. Yeah. Rain and Blood just sounds like they're in a hurry to get the hell out of there. It's just
I love Rain and Blood, but I mean, you know, it is a, you know, love it or hate it record. Yeah. But you know what album from the early Slayer days I love is Live Undead. I don't know. Just Tom sounds so fucking evil on it. Like, I was listening to it, and I was just like, ah, this is so, like, ah, just makes me want to just knock shit over.
Just a little thing that I remember when they actually came out, Live Undead. It was just a thing that just popped up. It wasn't a big release at all.
It wasn't. I mean, well, that was when they were on Metal Blade, which was a very underground label at the time.
That was when they did their best stuff, actually.
That was before they signed to Def Jam.
Yeah, they got Rubenized. Yeah. No, I find the Metal Blade stuff to be the best stuff. Even the Haunting the Chapel EP, I really like quite a bit.
Yeah, it's great. Like, there's just something really raw about Live Undead. Like, it just seems like early Slayer, like, at their rawest and just most ferocious. Like, it just sounds like they're warriors of, like, the LA wasteland. I don't know.
The thing is, what I found different was I managed to get the all the albums off CD, but not the remasters, because apparently they're just complete abomination. So I managed to track down, like, the really first, the actual first pressing of Show No Mercy and Hell Awaits, which were released on Metal Blade on this really odd looking. You know, you got a CD, right, and it's got a back and it's got a like the jewel case.
Yeah.
Well, these ones came in a white jewel case, which was slim. Mm-hmm. And to actually get the CD out, you had to actually bend the back jewel case. It flipped down. That's how you
weird.
Got. Yeah, I remember they did a whole run. They had, like, Venom on there, had Slayer on there, and they had a bunch of other artists, which I think Agent Steel might have been on there. I can't remember. I don't know. But I got these first pressings. I also managed to get vinyl rips of the first few albums. Like, I did hear the remaster of Show No Mercy and the original vinyl rip, and there's a huge difference in sound. I mean, the vinyl rip completely destroys a remaster of that. It sounds unauthentic. So I just went for the organic sounding ones.
Remasters more often than not fuck up the sound of a record.
Oh god, Megadeth's remaster of Rust in Peace. Anybody thinking about buying it, don't. Try your hardest to track down the original pressing, because that is just, I don't know what Dave was thinking when he did that, because Five Magics and Take No Prisoners, not remastered, he's re-recorded the vocals altogether for some reason. I don't know why.
Well, that was like with the M83. He re-released that album with him doing the vocals.
Yeah. MD45. It's not M80, a good album.
Yeah. I can't remember. I listened to it once and went, nope.
It's not good. Yeah.
No, it's terrible.
Yeah.
Although I'm curious what this new Slayer record's going to sound like.
First one in 6 years.
First one without Jeff and Dave.
And Dave Lombardi, yeah.
I heard Dave's band Film.
Mm-hmm.
And he really tears it up on the drums on that, like, more so than he does in Slayer. I was like, wow, he's
did you ever hear
jamming out
early shit he did with Grip Incorporated or Grip Inc?
No.
Oh man, you want to hear Lombardo going ape shit on drums, then you gotta get those two fucking albums that he did, those two or three albums.
I'll check that out. I'm reading a book called like Slayer 66 and 2/3, the Jeff and Dave years by DX Ferris. That's a really, if you're a Slayer fan, that's a really good book to check out. It kind of chronicles the early years of Slayer. It's the Jeff and Dave years, and it pays particular attention to Lombardo and Hanneman, but it has a lot of great anecdotes and stories in there.
There's a album that came out back in the mid-80s, which no one would fucking remember, but I do. And me and my mate used to listen to it all the time. This band called Bloodcum. And what they had on there was Jeff Hanneman's... I think it was Jeff Hanneman's brother playing on it.
Okay, I didn't know he had a brother. I know Tom has a brother.
Okay, it might have been Tom Araya's brother then.
And okay, also, John Araya, I know, is out there doing stuff that's more obscure.
Yeah, they only did the one fucking album. This album called Bloodcum. I don't know if it was titled anything. It was a white album with just their name on the front.
That's what the name of Metallica's Load practically was, Bloodcum. Just the cover was Bloodcum.
No, that was retitled Load of Shit here in Australia.
The cover is just that, was it? I saw this thing. It was about Metallica's Load, and it was like, did you know it was Blood and Semen? I'm like, yeah, it's a Serrano piece. That guy gets paid millions to just piss and jizz on stuff.
Oh, wow.
He did the Piss Christ, which was a piece that was paid for by taxpayer money. It was just Jesus in a bottle of urine.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, that was stupid.
Oh, whoa. Ted Nugent's stranglehold is being used on the next Kate Upton and Carl's Jr. Super Bowl commercial.
No shit.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
God, those Carl's Jr. commercials are ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, shit.
It's going to be really sleazy.
Do you remember when I was talking to you guys a few weeks... Remember when I was talking to you guys a few weeks back and I said, what was the name of that place that was at restaurant at airports and shit? No one could think of it? Mm-hmm. That was it, Carl's Jr.
Oh, really?
That's the one I was thinking of. They were everywhere.
I've never seen them at airports.
Yeah, I've seen them at airports. Yeah, yeah.
Hmm.
I haven't seen them at airports.
I've never eaten at a Hardee's or a Carl's Jr. just because the pictures of their food looks like death. Like, it looks like if you eat it, you'll die.
It looks like it.
Seriously, it's the best food.
I'm sure it is.
Is it really?
It's so fucking fat.
Yes, it is.
Nice.
Like, I mean, it looks delicious, but
no, seriously,
like,
look, the sandwiches are like 1,100 calories.
I look at pictures of them and I'm like, I don't want to open that box. I don't want to keep that as an option.
No, dude, they're great. Their food is, I mean, Hardee's, it's supposedly the same thing, same menu.
It is the same thing, yeah.
Right, but it's like, what I get at Carl's Jr., the quality's way above, other fast food.
Maybe that's why in the future, an Idiocracy, that, Carl's Jr. has a stranglehold on everything.
Well, I think Mike Judge put that in as a tribute. Carl's
Jr. I love that. You are an unfit mother. Your children are now the property of Carl's Jr. Is this the unfit mother? No, my name's... Take the unfit mother down to the station.
It's funny that's such a... That movie was so accurate, yet barely released at the time.
It was. I remember...
It was so relevant.
They were saying, oh, we don't know how to market it. I was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, I think they were scared of it. It's besides President Camacho, that's probably the most far-fetched thing in there.
Oh, by the way...
We don't have macho presidents anymore, please.
By the way, did you see Terry Crews on Adam Carolla's Take a Knee podcast?
I haven't listened to it yet.
I haven't listened to it either, but Carolla released clips from it. And Terry Crews is so great. He's like, everybody wants a piece of the pie, man, but you don't realize... America's a kitchen, man. Go make your own pie.
Yeah, he's a cool dude. I just read an interview with him in Muscle and Fitness, and he was awesome.
I was just like, boom, right there.
Yeah.
Go make your own action star.
I rewatched the Expendables 1 and 2 about a week or so back. And while I really liked them both quite a bit, actually, even number 2, Terry Crews just seems to have made a fucking career out of mimicking Mr. T. He just grimaces the same way.
No, he's too restrained. He doesn't scream as dialogue.
Well, here's the thing about Cruise, though, that I like is that I think he's really great doing comedy. I think he can do action. And I'll bet you if you gave him the chance to do drama, he could do that, too. I think he's extremely talented as a performer.
Oh, God.
If you watch him on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, he's a riot.
Oh, I want to see that show so bad.
He's terrific with the comedic dialogue and everything. It's just delivery's good.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, there's just something about him that's so likable. Like,
yeah. Well, he looks like the hardworking American. He busted his ass to get there. He doesn't look like the spoiled brat like Sean Penn.
Yeah.
Who has this alleged fantastic acting talent that you never see.
Sean Penn is tortured, man.
All he does is cry.
Oh, he's tortured.
And he was just some pussy from Malibu.
His children were murdered by Tim Robbins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, fucking phonies. In, Mickey Rourke wannabes.
In Mystic River, Mickey Rourke wannabes. Was it Tim Robbins is watching John Carpenter's Vampires? They're like vampires. Vampires, man.
Gee, that was a Clint Eastwood movie, wasn't it? Mystic
River. It was.
Jeez.
It was.
That's why I haven't watched
it.
Fucking Clint Eastwood movie for years. I can't even think of the last one he directed that I actually gave a shit about.
Gran Torino was fucking great.
I still
haven't seen it. Okay, I gotta admit,
Gran Torino
is fantastic,
absolute magic. It's Unforgiven levels of great.
Does he venture into the sort of Harry Brown level
No, absolutely not.
Not really.
Absolutely not. It's like the anti Harry Brown.
Because Harry Brown was fucking awesome. That was a good movie.
It's,
that one.
It's a very good movie. It takes a very different tack from Harry Brown, but it's not trying to be that. You know.
Okay.
But, I didn't see Jersey Boys. I kind of heard mixed things.
I enjoy Jersey Boys, but it's not great.
I want to see it because I've always wanted to see the stage play because I like Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons.
I think that American Sniper Bradley Cooper he deserves any awards he gets for that because he's so good. Like, if you watch any interview with Chris Kyle, he got it down, and just it's brilliant.
He's playing Mac Bolan, the executioner, next, so he's actually got his work cut out for him.
He's great, and like, you know, he put on the weight and just, you know, did all that stuff. And you know, the movie's gotten some flack for some of technical things. Like, there is a scene with a very obviously fake baby. Mm-hmm. And but
Eastwood is so cheap.
What the producer said was, first baby got sick, second baby didn't show up. Clint Eastwood's like, just grab a doll and do it, like, because Eastwood's like, get the scene done.
Yeah, and you know, that's why he fired Phil Kaufman off of Outlaw Josie Wales.
Yeah,
because Phil Kaufman was trying to be David Lean or Kubrick.
Yeah, he was trying to like wait for the clouds to get right.
Just imagine, I just imagine the set of that American Sniper with the thing. Just get the doll.
Yeah, no, the Jason Hall, the producer, said it was like Clint Eastwood voice. Give me the doll, kid. and you know, there are moments in the movie too where like it just. Little bits feel rushed, and I'm thinking of like some special effects moments, but the baby as well. But it's a side effect of Eastwood's, like, you know, get it done in two takes. Let's move on. And sometimes it works in his favor, and sometimes it doesn't. And there are moments in American Sniper where it doesn't. But Bradley Cooper like just nails every scene, even the moments like the fake baby, like, you know, he's giving it 100%. like honestly, the director should have been the DOP or Eastwood should have been like, you know, when he's patting that baby, it's kind of jiggling weird. Like, let's
we need to name that episode this "Give Me the Doll, Kid."
Yeah, but that's what the producer said on Twitter. He said Eastwood voice, "Give me the doll, kid."
all I know about that movie is it's offending all the right people. Well, on the web, so I don't care.
That's the thing is what the thing about American Sniper is, it's a litmus test for political beliefs in America.
Let me say this. The thing that pissed me off about this movie the most is the fact that, okay, I'm not a fan of Michael Moore's by a long stretch, right? But the way he was attacked for his beliefs on American Sniper, and Seth Rogen as well. I'm not a fan of Seth Rogen, but the fact that they actually come out and say what they want about the film, whether it's positive or negative against it, and then being attacked for their views is bullshit. And that's what I dislike about it.
I'd have more sympathy.
Except Michael Moore was lying about his uncle being killed by a sniper.
And Michael Moore also said, I wasn't talking about American Sniper.
Yeah,
I was talking about the guy who killed Martin Luther King.
Do you know who actually... I'm pretty sure it was this person. You know who actually was who found out about Michael Moore lying about his uncle being killed by a sniper? It was Bill.
Oh, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, he did.
Yeah.
How the fuck he drags up stuff and finds shit. But I got no idea how he does it.
But Bill just has a bullshit detector, and he checks stuff. You know, like, he's a smart guy, but
he's not one of these. In Seth Rogen's case, I just fucking hate Seth Rogen.
Well, and Seth Rogen did a similar thing to Moore, where he tried to backtrack.
Yeah, what are they all backpedal for? This is what pisses me off. Why are they all backpedaling on their
that's
his stance?
Fucking own it, because so many other people in the blogosphere said way worse about him, and they stand by it. Like, Seth Rogen's like, I was just making an observation. I don't think he's like a Nazi.
I say worse about it on Twitter as well.
I was just like, okay, but like, you know, but they walked it back, so, you know, they're pussies too.
Exactly, because you can't...
They're chicken shit leftist. What do you expect?
But the thing is the movie in America has been a litmus test for political beliefs. And, you know, sites that are on the left say the movie, they'll either do the, I'm not saying anything about Chris Kyle, I'm not commenting, but it doesn't, but, you know, he wasn't a hero because he fought for this cause or blah, blah, blah. But the movie is very much, it frames Kyle in the, he is a man who is a rare breed of dog, a sheepdog, a protector. That's what the movie frames him as a certain rare breed of man it's not commenting on politics. It's not commenting on war. It's commenting on what it means. It's commenting on masculinity. And he's a guy who protects people. He's a guy who is a protector to his flock. He's almost like a shepherd. And it was kind of putting him in that category. It was talking about this type of person, what this type of person does and what this type of person goes through.
That's
what I liked about the movie.
Another angle they go at is the fact that Kyle had problems telling tall stories.
Well, yeah.
And here's how I saw it. I said, oh, so did you guys complain when Ron Kovic lied about how he got wounded and born on the 4th of July?
Oh, no,
did you talk about John Kerry, who was absolutely cowardly when all of his fellow servicemen said he's been bullshitting about a lot of stuff?
No, and that's one of the things
that lost the election for him.
Well, and the thing about the difference between a person like Kyle and a person like Kovic or Kelly, I mean, Kerry, is that, you know, Chris Kyle has had a penchant for tall tales. You know, it's probably likely he didn't punch out Jesse Ventura. However, his service record has never come under question.
I know. It's 160 confirmed kills. You can't
confirmed kills.
He's like, still a hero in the battlefield. And the thing is, if you look at all military heroes throughout history, they're all flawed men.
Oh, absolutely.
You know. That's just the world. Nobody's Roy Rogers.
Now, this Chris Kyle, he's dead, isn't he?
Yes. Yeah, he is dead.
How did he die?
He was... He started helping veterans suffering from PTSD, and he would spend time with them. And a lot of times they would go to gun ranges and talk and shoot guns and, you know, just do stuff like that. And he did it with this one guy that a friend of his family wanted him to – who was a veteran, wanted, you know, him to go out with him. And the guy snapped and shot him when they were out at the gun range.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
It's a die by the sword. If I've ever heard one,
no, it is a die by the sword moment, but you know, it's sad because I mean, you know, he died trying to help someone.
Not good. Not good.
Yeah, it sucks, but you know.
Well, now you quickly talked about it. What would you give it out of a grading? What you want to give it? Like an 8
out of 10?
Yeah, out of 10 if you want.
I'd say about a 7 or an 8.
Okay.
It does have technical problems.
Maybe.
And I would... well, you know, I'm not sure. 7 or an 8, I still need to... I might need to see it again. But it also... There are elements of it that just feel a little Hollywood to me.
Mm.
Like for a biopic, like there's this... there's this sniper that's like a rival... Arab sniper to him.
Oh, yeah,
that's completely fictionalized.
In the movie, and as Steve Saylor pointed out, Middle Easterners are more of the spray and pray types.
Was it played by Ron Silver?
No, it wasn't played by Ron Silver.
I think Paul Talbot, who's been on the show, put up a photo of the guy and said he looks like the Giggler from Death Wish 3.
It's not played by Robert Forrester either. Just
But, not Forrest Whitaker?
Forrest Whitaker.
He's got a lazy eye.
A lazy eye, but that's what makes him good. But no, like he's like this Olympic sniper that like is this gold medalist. But you know, Steve Saylor pointed out that there have been only like three Arab countries that have ever won a gold medal at sniping and shooting. And he said they're more of the spray and pray types. Which
that was like that sniper who picked up a rifle. So, oh man, I can't use this. The scope's out. No, it's not yours. It's actually Forrest Whitaker's.
Right. So there are parts of the movie that also it feels like Hollywood stuff.
Mm.
But everything in the movie that like Bradley Cooper's performance just is so good, and his domestic life, the depiction of PTSD in domestic life is the best I've ever seen. Like, it's way better than anything in like the Hurt Locker or anything like that. Where
they get confused at the cereal aisle.
Well, there's
let's slap the troops in the face there.
Yeah, no, I mean, well, like, here's the thing: is like, it has.
What are you looking at, you packet of Cheerios?
There is one moment where it goes a little too far, and I don't know if it's in his book or something, but where like. A dog jumps on a kid and he kind of like grabs the dog off and starts pulling his belt off, and then he realizes how he looks and he's like, oh. But there are bits where he's like driving down the street and you see a truck behind him that kind of looks like a truck that gave him trouble in an earlier scene in Iraq. And there are moments at home that almost feel more intense than war. And I was like, that must be what PTSD feels like, where being at home is – somehow more upsetting and intense than being in battle, because being in battle, that's like what you know. That's the way the world is. And when you get home, it's just, who are these people going on with their lives? These fucking, you know, what's going on? What do they know, you know, about the world? And that it really captured that part of it that I think a lot of movies miss. Like, they're just, the Hurt Locker's just like, man, going to the grocery store is not as intense as defusing bombs. Better go back to Iraq, you know.
Well, the other thing is, I was arguing with somebody about it. They were bringing up the left wing thing that they're all cutting and pasting. And then I just said, you know, all I can figure out is Chris Kyle must have looked like a lot of jock bullies that gave wedgies to these
kids. That's what it comes down to.
That's totally what it is. He looks like the jock bully.
It's like Pauline Kael used to say about Clint Eastwood. He looks like men I didn't like growing up.
She also said that about Steve McQueen. She hated Steve McQueen.
Yeah, they look like guys I didn't like.
No. It's like, go get your dyke ass, rug munch town. And,
well, it's funny because,
fucking critics are the worst. They're like those neurotic geeks.
Who's that black gay one? Armin White?
Armin White.
Oh, yeah, he's actually one of the better ones.
He's entertaining, yeah.
He's
one of he writes for National Review now.
Yeah.
Okay.
And The Advocate occasionally.
And the left hates him. He's fucking gay.
You know who his favorite film critic was? Roger Ebert.
Pauline Kael.
No. It was Roger Ebert.
Who's Roger Ebert's favorite?
No. Harmon White's favorite critic was Roger Ebert.
No, he fucking hated Roger Ebert.
No, not with that mouth, mate. He's like, man, I got some fun with you.
No, there was a public dispute. And Harmon White said that Roger Ebert's coasted into his job and is a genuinely poor writer and broke down his review style. Perfectly.
Jeez.
He destroyed Ebert. And,
yeah, he talked
and
about how
for Ebert, that Armand White got banned from Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, he talked about how he said Ebert infantilized film criticism, and he's absolutely.
And he did.
Like, Armand White loves Pauline Kael, because Pauline Kael, even though I disagree with a lot of her reviews, she's an insanely good writer. Pauline Kael, I think if you want to write film criticism, Harlan Ellison said, you should be able to write at least as good as Pauline Kael.
Exactly.
John, I want to ask John quickly. You used to watch Siskel and Ebert, right?
Yeah, I did.
How did you find Gene Siskel?
I saw it when it was sneak previews on PBS.
How did you find Gene Siskel as a critic?
Slightly better than Ebert. Okay. I never read Siskel's reviews. I read Roger Ebert's reviews and thought he was an idiot. And even when I was a kid, I thought it was bad writing. You know?
Okay. All right, just curious.
Well, and the thing is Ebert, brought petty emotion into everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he would do a lot of pearl clutching in his reviews. Yes. I'm so offended, and I was actually, even though I like his writing a lot as a film critic, Harlan Ellison had a tendency to do the same fucking thing.
Yeah. That's why he was never employed as a real film critic.
Yeah, because he acted like he saw couples jerking each other off to the head beheadings in The Omen, which is totally bullshit.
No, he's very given into emotion.
He talked about a soft, fleshy couple sitting next to me, and yes, as they rubbed each other's genitals.
you know what's funny about Ellison is if you read his old writing, he talks he rips on fat people, but then if you look at him now, he looks like a fat old lesbian. And he had a heart attack when he was 72 or something. He wasn't that old, and he had a crazy heart attack and a near-death experience and stuff, and he used to rip on people, hey, eating at McDonald's toad burgers, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, I guess you weren't living off salads and chicken breast your whole life.
Okay, fat old lesbian, that's 10 unfollowers right there. Okay, keep count for this episode.
There goes any Harlan Ellison fans who we picked up from
here's the thing, I like Harlan Ellison's writing, but he can be a frustrating person to like.
He's a hypocrite.
He is a hypocrite.
He's as much of a hypocrite
and he's a litigious douche, too.
Yeah, he's as bad as Jesse Ventura.
Yeah.
Jesse Ventura's been suing people since the 80s.
Well, and a lot of people were saying that Ventura's libel suit against Kyle's estate wasn't going to come out of his wife's pocket. Apparently, she's claiming it is.
Oh, is that who he sued the widow of?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that makes things a bit more interesting now. Okay.
Yeah.
I gotcha.
Because he said in his book that he punched a SEAL at a party who was criticizing Bush and the troops and was being a drunken idiot. And later on television, he said that person was Jesse Ventura, and Ventura sued him. But Kyle was murdered shortly thereafter, but Ventura chose to continue with the lawsuit, and that's why a lot of people are pissed at him, because they saw him as trying to wring money out of a dead serviceman's wife, you know.
Oops.
And then if he's asked about it, he goes, but what about Halliburton?
Yeah.
What about 9/11?
If I was president, I would change the system.
Yes.
God.
The young people would vote for me.
Apparently him and Gavin McInnes like argue a lot on his show.
I have never seen that. I haven't seen it either.
But...
what about Halliburton?
I live off the grid. That's why I do a show.
I live in Mexico. I don't watch television. I just read.
Exercise your mind.
Slack-jawed
faggots.
The slack-jawed fags. All right, it's another 20 there, hey, gone.
Man, not getting this on iTunes. Special bonus episode.
If you're offended by that, you just haven't seen Predator, all right? Go watch Predator.
There you go. Yeah, okay. Anyway.
If you listen to me, you'll be a goddamn sexual tyrannosaurus, just like me.
The Ventura Mean Gene Okerlund ticket for 2016, right? All right. Anyway, let's get into the film that we're supposed to be talking about 95 minutes ago. It's,
yeah, because we never do this.
No. We never really banter before a thing, but we've had a bit of a break, so indulge us. Anyway, so this week we're going to talk from 1973, is it? 1973's The Seven Ups, starring Roy Scheider, which really shits me when people say Roy Schneider.
Really? It makes me think he was a member of the B-52s.
Or Twisted Sister. Like, is D and my dad Roy Schneider. Well, it's Schneider, but close enough.
The Seven Ups! Lobster!
Here it goes, a car chase! There it goes, a broken door!
Bosses!
But the movie's produced and directed by Philip D'Antoni, and The Seven Ups is sort of the less famous entry in his trilogy of revolutionary car chase movies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because D'Antoni produced Bullet, starring Steve McQueen, directed by Peter Yates, and he also produced... one of our favorite movies here at the MMC, The French Connection.
Which, oddly enough, was what we were going to cover until... Was it John who suggested Seven Ups instead?
Possibly.
Yeah.
It was either me or John. I don't know.
One of you two, yeah.
And I was thinking that was the more less discussed of the two.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Like French Connection, if you want to review the French Connection on other podcasts, I'm sure you won't have any trouble finding one. But Seven Ups is not really spoken about that much, and... it's widely available, so it's not like it's one of those hard to find titles that was going to be a struggle to watch, and so we thought we'd do it. So who had seen it before? I know John, you hadn't seen it, huh?
No, I hadn't. I knew about it, and I was like, that would be a good excuse for me to watch it.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I'd seen it once before, only that was a number of years back, and I really enjoyed it quite a bit back then, but. Who wants to synopsize this thing?
Ooh, because it's all over the place.
It is. That's the thing. It's all over the place.
I'm going to try. All right. So, Roy Scheider plays a New York cop, and he's very much in the vein of his cop from French Connection. I think he's even based on the same
name. He's pretty much the cop.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sonny Grosso,
with a last name change.
Yeah, he's the same. He's based on the same cop who is a technical advisor on both films.
In French Connection, he's Buddy Russo. In this one, he's Buddy Manucci. So,
yep.
Go figure.
He dresses like him. It's basically the same character, but he's part of a NYPD force called the Seven Ups, and they're cops that don't play by the rules. You know, they're sort of. Like,
rogue. They're rogue.
Yeah, there's an opening sequence where they bust this counterfeiting operation. But the way they do it, I was like, is that legal? I was like, I can't believe you could do that and make it stick.
Yeah.
Like, they used a lot of, like, really dirty, almost prankster tactics to, like, if this was in the hands of a different director, it could have been, like, a comedy setup. You know?
Oh, like a Richard Lester, for sure.
Yeah, like a Richard Lester or a Blake Edwards or something. Like, it could have been a comedy thing where they bust crimes through, like, just sort of these terroristic scenarios where, you know, one of them goes in, they go, one, it's like this antique dealership that's a front for counterfeiting. Roy Scheider goes in acting like he's looking for an item. One of the cops walks in pretending to be a water cooler guy. Roy Scheider knocks him over. You know, one of the guys comes running the operation, comes down, is like, what's going on? Like, Roy Scheider, like, starts a fight with him. And then they kind of bust it through the chaos that they create. So it's very strange. But there's a kidnapping ring that is kidnapping mafia types, like upper class, like mafia heavyweights, and ransoming them for money. And Roy Scheider is his informant is the Tony LoBianco character, and he's trying to crack this case, but it gets incredibly convoluted, and it leads to some a really spectacular car chase. It leads to a bunch of some of the 7-Ups officers getting killed, and
a trail of vengeance and going above the law to avenge the the lawman.
Exactly. It's very hard to synopsize, but yeah. It is one of those. It's one of those cop movies where you're kind of you kind of have to recalibrate to get your bearings a little bit.
This takes at least two viewings.
Yeah, it does.
Really get the flow of what's happening.
But the action and all of the suspense scenes are so well done that it remains engaging, even if you have a hard time following what's going on.
Yeah.
Also, the acting is pretty much from top to bottom incredible.
It is.
It's minimalist. It's not overdone. It's not that Tarantino-esque hipster dialogue or anything. It's very much the story, meat and potatoes and everything. But you've got guys like Richard Lynch and Joe Spinell as like villains.
I love that Joe Spinell was in this.
I tell you what,
that's how you know it's a New York movie.
I sat down and sort of went through the filmography of Roy Scheider. I thought, man, if one guy had a decent run throughout the 70s more than any other actor just about, it was friggin' Roy Scheider. Now I looked at Joe Spinell's, I'm like, this guy's just about topped it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spinell, he was in Rocky. He wrote Maniac.
Starred in Maniac. Do you know, actually, I don't know if I've ever brought this up about The Godfather Part 2. About Joe Spinell, and that was in Spinell in one or part two?
I think he was in part two.
Part two. On the Godfather companion book I've got, the second highest paid actor ever on the Godfather set was Joe Spinell.
Really?
Because what he would do was he would sneakily sign on every day, and he hoodwinked Francis Ford Coppola into saying, "I want to learn about filmmaking. Can I sign on every day and be with you during the filmmaking process?" And Coppola's like, "Yeah, whatever." And it ends up, Spinell's the second highest paid actor because he's there every day, basically.
Makes sense.
Yeah, they see he was a shrewd guy when it came to that sort of stuff. So behind Pacino on part two, Joe Spinell was the highest paid actor.
Here's Spinell's run. He was in The Godfather, 7-Ups, Godfather Part 2, Taxi Driver, Rocky,
yep.
Sorcerer, Big Wednesday, Paradise Alley.
Oh, he knew all those guys. He knew all the filmmakers.
Yeah.
Rocky 2, Cruising.
Losing it.
The Ninth Configuration.
Yep.
Maniac, Nighthawks, Night Shift. And then it's kind of a bunch of stuff.
Losing it.
He's also...
haven't heard of.
He's also in some Spielberg Oscar video that Spielberg shot like in 75 or something, where it's like Spinell and another guy are like cheering for Spielberg while they watch the Oscars.
There was this video Spielberg did about when they were announcing the Oscars the year Jaws came out.
Yeah.
And Spielberg was like, "They're just jealous of my success."
Yeah, something like that.
And One of my friends posted that video online and was acting like it was this Spielberg, you know, was robbed, and you know, but I was like, I don't want to see a filmmaker talk about how brilliant he is and why he deserved all the awards. Like, it's just,
yeah,
it's just something. It's just gross. I don't know.
But yeah,
I have to respect Woody Allen for never attending.
Yeah,
he just goes plays with his jazz band.
Oh, on the
I'd rather go play my clarinet in the jazz club.
And the winner is Annie Hall. Yeah.
And meanwhile, Star Wars fans are like, it was robbed!
Sorcerer was robbed, not fucking Star Wars.
Hell yeah.
By the way, Oscar announcements this year, everybody's like, the Lego movie, why wasn't the Lego movie robbed? Yeah, I can't believe that the insert corporate name here movie was robbed of a nomination of an award recognizing artistic excellence.
No. Say it for what it really is. Yo, man, can't believe black people got robbed.
No.
Hey, Spike. Fucking whinging little shit midget. Seriously.
Talked about Spike a lot lately on the show. Who blocked me on Twitter years ago, by the way?
There you go. That's what you get, Spike. You think where... You think
look like a cricket?
Spike's going to go on a print our, you know, post our addresses on Twitter now. Yeah, man, you can find John Grace here and the Stuart Bulk here.
There's so many John Graces in Colorado.
Oh, is it? Oh, you're lucky then.
Oh, yeah. It's a common thing.
He'll probably post the wrong address like last time. He'll have to pay them a bunch of money.
Funny because I sometimes think Michael Moore will block me. He never does, no matter what mean stuff you send to him. Because when he was doing his thing where he says he can't believe all these conservatives have violent fantasies about him or about killing him. And I said, yeah, that's very rude of them. After all, diabetes will take you off the earth in a few years.
You know what? I actually like Twitter these days more than Facebook. I've really gone off Facebook. Like, I much prefer Twitter. It's just like a fucking all-in brawl, really, is what it is.
Twitter really is like, it's like pro wrestling for social
media. It really is, yeah. It's like what's that, what they call it? What's that one they got 20 in the ring? What's it called? Royal Rumble. It's like a Royal Rumble for social media. Yeah.
Whereas Facebook is a little more passive aggressive.
It's more controlled as well. And you got, you know, people who can actually, well, then again, I've been blocked by fuck knows how many people in the last two weeks.
I tend to stay pretty safe with what I post, but when I comment on other stories is where I get my political shit out on Facebook, which I've noticed people can see that, so
yeah
but
who cares?
I'm just like, okay, so it's more passive aggressive.
Anyway, back to 7-Ups. We're talking about
7-Ups. Yes. But didn't this, when you guys watched this, didn't you think it felt like French Connection?
Oh, a lot.
Like, I mean, and D'Antoni really, he used a lot of the same crew, like the same stunt people, and
I actually said it was to me it was the real French Connection 2, not the Frankenheimer movie.
Yeah, it feels French Connection.
I said just like the way that Dance of the Drunken Mantis is the real Drunken Master 2, not the Jackie Chan, you know, movie from the 90s. It's just because it's the same style, same like similar vibe, you know, similar story in a way. Just that the whole feel is like a real continuation.
Like, and even though like the story is pretty tough to follow, the suspense scenes are still like that car wash scene is so good.
It is.
They pop the handcuffs on the door so they can't get out, and then pry it open and take the money. That's so good.
Yeah, it's very clever.
And the car chase,
man. Here we go. Car chase. Oh! I think out of the three of the D'Antoni films, this is probably the best of them.
I agree with you.
Because the other two are really good, but what they do is they got obstacles in the way. They got under the bridge, the Brooklyn Bridge in French Connection. I think that's the bridge they're using now. I don't remember.
And the thing about French Connection is, when I think of French Connection, I don't think of the car chase. I think of Popeye getting shot at, because those scenes were really intense to me.
Yeah,
the car chase was good, but The scene where Popeye is being shot at by a sniper, like, that felt visceral. Like, there was that part of the movie was more memorable to me. That and the ending.
Yeah.
And the 7-Ups, I thought the car chase, like, I mean, it's still burned into my brain when the car gets in front of the bus and the dude pulls out the shotguns waiting for Roy Scheider to, like, pull up next to him so he can blow his car. I mean, it was great.
It is. And that's the thing as well with Bullets 1. Bullet was really good, but you dealt with the hills of San Francisco. So it was up and down, up and down.
Yeah.
Whereas this one, for pure flat-out pedal-to-the-floor 7-ups is the best of the three, I find.
And all of the car action in it, it felt so natural. Like, it felt like they were really shooting it in traffic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, the cars didn't feel like they knew what was going on. Like, all of it, just the way people react, the other cars reacted to the chase, felt real. Like, it didn't feel staged at all.
Although that car flying down the street and then someone conveniently opening a car door right the very second that his car
but you know, still that looked awesome.
It looked great, but it was you could tell
it was like
some fucking grip in the car, just like open the door now.
Absolutely, but I'm talking more about the other cars just on the street driving, like felt.
Oh, really, totally, yeah. It looked very.
But there's never like the convenient ramp. With the workers going, no, no, no!
you know, it replaced that cliche with the kids all congregated in the street, and then they all run out of the way, and then when they run back in the street, you're like, no!
Yeah.
The thing I thought about that...
We didn't get the vegetable cart, you know, that the guy runs over, and then the guy comes out shaking his fist.
Or the homeless person with a shopping cart, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, with all their, you know, their cans go flying everywhere or some shit.
And there was the lady with the stroller and French Connection.
There was. But the thing is with this one as well, it felt like to me at the very start when the chase started, you had those kids like looking over their shoulder as they were driving past. I'm like, man, I'm looking like at a fucking high-speed Spandau Ballet video. That's what it felt like to me for a few seconds, you know? It's like, it felt like some sort of 80s synth pop music video with a car chase inserted into it. But it got better from there, you know?
But like, you know, the other scenes, even other than the great car chase, just scenes like him in the hospital.
Yeah. With,
it was just, man, this is like perfect. And where they're threatening the mobster and his wife, you know, and breaking the vase
over the
nights. It's like everything is edited perfectly to like perfect, like tight impact. You really feel like you're in New York. Everybody looks like New Yorkers.
Oh, yeah.
The big problem I have with a lot of movies after like the 1980s is they start to look like California people in New York.
Yeah,
it's like the Woody Allen joke in Hollywood Ending.
Yeah.
Woody Allen made observations about that in his own movies.
Right. There's no like Pilates trained, you know, bleach blonde types anywhere in the film.
It's no,
like,
everybody
looks Jewish, Italian, or Irish.
Joe Spinell. That pretty much sums up New York.
Right.
It felt like the set of Maniac or something.
It really
yeah,
did.
It, and it's got a gritty look. It's nothing like says notice me in the movie. That's what I like. It's like, you know, the kind of docudrama style the way it's made. Like
that,
it's
like, you know, and it's the same feel that French Connection had with Friedkin. You know, who would bring, like, you know, his movies, he kind of prided himself on that documentary feel, you know. And but I think the fact that 7-Ups retains that feel speaks to the team behind the movie that D'Antoni assembled. Because I'm not really, you know, a believer in the auteur theory. I think directors are important, but I think the behind-the-scenes people are very important as well.
That's because you've actually worked on movie sets.
Exactly. But, you know, you look at a movie like this and it feels so much like French Connection. And yeah, like, I'm sure Friedkin brought something really important to French Connection, because you watch a lot of his movies. They have an intensity just like French Connection. Like, you look at Live and Die in L.A., The Hunted, you know, movies we've talked about on the show, The Sorcerer. But then you look at something like this and it largely captures that same feel. And I think a lot of it has to do with the team that works on a movie. You've got the cinematographer, you've got the stunt coordinator, you've got, you know, all these people that work behind the scenes to sort of make a movie come together. And anybody who's worked on a movie knows that. Like, the auteur theory was invented by Truffaut and Godard before they actually started making movies. And even then, they worked in a situation where it was in France, where they sort of cater to that, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like, it's like Karl Marx writing all about labor and he didn't have a job.
Well, it's like, what was it? I saw an article talking about how Clint Eastwood is America's only, not to bring it back to Clint, but his America's only octogenarian filmmaker. But you look at the problem of American Sniper, but then you look at Godard's latest film in 3D, and you know he's an octogenarian in Europe, and I'm just like, okay,
yeah.
We're comparing Clint unfavorably to Godard's recent output. All right.
I think seriously, if you're writing about new movies, it's a zero sum game. It really is. I realized this year, I was like, because like Garrow posted like his 10 best and his 10 worst on Facebook, and because he loves to do that, I said, you know, I think I've seen maybe 2 movies on your list. It's like, this feels awesome. Like, this is the year I've outgrown caring about new movies.
Yeah,
because I really feel like that's a kid thing or something.
I don't care anymore.
Well, keeping up with new movies is a young man's game.
Yeah,
it really is.
Well, they're all made for young men. They're not made.
Yeah,
for
they are.
Like, where's the 7-Ups? When's the last time you saw something like the 7-Ups?
Exactly. Hang on, let me just go right there. You tell me now if they remade the 7-Ups, this would be full of fucking cast under the age of 25. Guarantee you. Yeah. And you show me one person one person under 25 in this movie. Nobody, except for the kids in the street. That's about it.
Yeah,
the youngest probably would have been Roy Scheider's copper mates, it would have been like maybe 30. That's about it. But all the rest, like, you tell me how you can tell me these days how you can market someone like Roy Scheider if he was an actor today. You would have to do
what you did with him in The Punisher.
Joe Spinell,
Frank Castle's dad, you know.
Yeah, Joe Spinell wouldn't have a hope in hell. Okay,
no
hope. He'd be like an extra. Okay, you can't market it, stick over here, just stand in the background, do something, that's it.
It's the character actor. You know, it's
shits me about films these days. Everything is fucking young. Hunger Games, the perfect example. Won't watch it. Don't care. Won't watch it.
Yeah.
Don't want to see it.
No, I haven't. I saw the first one. I haven't seen any of the other ones.
Well, you're a Judas, because I've watched none of them, and I won't watch none of them. You know?
Well, sometimes I see movies because a friend who I don't get to see a lot's in town, they want to see it, I go see
don't,
it.
Don't you want any friends? Don't you want to keep your friends?
This was somebody I'd written with the Breitbart site with and really wanted to hang out with.
So. Oh, okay. Oh, that's fair enough then. But, yeah. That films these days, like
I didn't see it and go, like, what a piece of shit. But I was, you know, I was like, it was all right. Not really my thing.
Plus, there's
a guy behind me who was asleep snoring the whole time.
Oh, good on him. Well done, mate. The thing is, I would have just... You should have just done what the rest of us did. I liked it better when it was called Battle Royale.
Well, yeah.
I was one of them.
It was called The Most Dangerous Game, and it was written in 1908.
Exactly. Ah, yeah. No, exactly. The Most Dangerous Game is the same concept, too.
Exactly.
Man, hunting humans.
That's a goddamn film we should fucking review one day. Yeah. Most Dangerous Game.
Yep.
Don't rule it out. We only got like 50 more years of this.
It's one of the cheap Criterion titles.
Is it really? Okay.
Yeah, I think it's one of the first ones they put out on DVD.
It's on Hulu.
I believe you're right. Yeah. I can stream it on Hulu Prime.
It's on Hulu, yeah. Anyway. Yeah. I got it there as well. So,
They put it out a while ago. They need to do a Blu-ray.
Yeah, well, it kind of reminded me watching this when I was a kid watching Roy Scheider movies in the 70s. Is to me as a kid, he seemed like the everyman.
Yeah.
And even now, I watch it and see the difference. I'm like, he's like the everyman.
Well, and that's something you got in like late 60s through the 70s movies. Like, Gene Hackman sort of seemed like a guy you would see in real life.
Yep.
Yeah.
Unlike the classic Hollywood movie star, which was, you know, the women were unrealistically beautiful, the men were very handsome.
Right. There's
a few exceptions. But, you know, in the 70s, you got, like, Gene Hackman in Bonnie and Clyde. You know, he's very – he looks like your neighbor. You know?
Right.
He's also very charismatic, you know.
Yeah.
Roy Scheider's kind of the same way, you know.
Yep,
he's the wiry, overworked guy.
Yeah, the sort of working class, blue collar looking dude.
Always like world weary over like getting like every movie's double crossed or lied to, and it's kind of like it's always a good performance.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in 7-Ups.
One of my favorite actors from the 70s, who was always a good supporting actor, was Albert Popwell. I liked him quite a bit.
Oh yeah,
you like him?
Yeah.
Black Peter.
He's in every Dirty Harry movie.
He's in the first 3 from memory. I know he's definitely in the first 2.
He's in Sudden Impact. He's basically the partner.
He is too. That's right. They go out in the woods and shoot firing ranges.
Right,
in the woods.
Right. And he gets murdered or whatever by the villains, and Harry has to avenge him. But like he's a robber in the first one.
He's the pimp. That's the best scene in the fucking movie.
He was sort of a pimp or a gangster, but also a source for Harry and the Enforcer, and then he's his partner in Sudden Impact.
Yeah. I quite liked him, and also the other guy, Alan Weeks, I liked him quite a bit as well. He used to pop up in a lot of blaxploitation stuff, and French Connection as well, the one that Gene Hackman and Roy Scheider were slapping around at the start against the wall. Against the brick wall. That's him, yeah.
What? Your feet in Poughkeepsie!
Did you guys ever get the sort of Italian crime movie vibe from this movie?
It was an inspiration.
Totally.
Because there were moments where, like, I don't know, it just felt like the characters were, like, the dubbing was sort of there, and...
Well, that's because New York is so noisy.
Yeah, they have to dub it in, and yeah. I was just thinking, I felt like I was watching an Italian crime movie.
Like a Mafia Massacre style, one of those types of films.
Yeah.
Maurizio Burley, the 8-ups. But Franco Nero. But it's what it is the 7-ups and the French Connection and Serpico and certainly Bullet and Dirty Harry were like big hits in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got that they were major influences on all those crazy Eurocrime movies. And so, you know, the inspiration is definitely there.
I need to see more of those because I haven't seen a ton of them.
They're fantastic. Not enough of them are on DVD. That's the problem. And I talked to the director of Eurocrime, and he said, you know, Kino was listening to suggestions or whatever, but there's kind of like a lot of the licenses are very expensive for America.
Well, and like
really,
Kino seems to be putting out just fucking anything on Blu-ray lately. Like they just put out Blu-rays of like Quatermass, Mr. Majestic.
They just announced. At the Earth's Core, which is selling like crazy.
Apparently. Yeah, like it just felt like I was seeing like 5 new Kino things every week, and it would be like an obscure Charles Bronson movie this week. And...
Yeah, they just announced An Eye for an Eye, the Chuck Norris film.
Yeah!
Where he's with Richard Roundtree and Christopher Lee and Professor Toru Tanaka. So.
I just picked up the Octagon the other day.
Yeah. On Blu-ray?
Well, they're doing it.
Yes. On Blu-ray? Yeah. Shit, we've had that leave for a bit. Fucking 3 years, I think. It's been out here forever.
I just got a good deal on it, and I was like, sweet.
Yeah. Got the Octagon. Fucking...
Like lots of Chuck Norris whispering to himself.
Oh yeah.
All in new digital stereo.
Yeah.
I watched...
It's like echoey.
Yeah.
I watched Force of One upstairs on the big screen on Blu-ray. Fucking...
Which was written by Ernest Tidyman.
Yes, it was. Yeah. Damn good film, actually. Really enjoyed that. Really enjoyed that one. But carry on. You were saying about the Italian crime dramas that it took a lot from films like Seven Ups and French Connection.
Yeah, they were hugely influenced because you could make that style of film pretty easily in Rome or Naples or wherever. You know,
or if you're Lucio Fulci, you come and make them in New York, and it's New York Ripper.
Right.
Which is... one of the most fucked up movies I've ever seen.
Oh, speaking of Italian movies, we're actually getting some Mark Gregory action in high definition in a few months. Getting them Bronx Warriors movies, yes.
Oh,
Bronx Warriors right. 1 and 2 in March, I believe they're dropping. March or April.
Oh, boy.
So excited.
Damn right. Blue Underground's doing it. As William Lustig did say a few months back, he's bringing them to Blu-ray. So I'm hoping... I'm not. It's not going to be a game breaker if they don't have it. But I'm hoping that they've got the original Italian language on there as well as English dub. That'll be interesting to see that because I've only ever seen it once on the foreign channel here. But if it's not there, it doesn't matter. I don't really care. I just want the actual all uncut film, whole uncut movie.
Yeah,
because I know that the VHS.
I gotta have the Larry Dolgan dubbing, so you know.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be there, but.
Come on, Trash. What are you doing hanging out with this cunt? Yeah, just 1 minute.
I just want to hear that drummer on the pier playing.
I've got that on an MP3 somewhere.
Oh, yeah. I've got the Bronx Warriors soundtrack as well, by the way.
It's a good, great soundtrack.
It's funny because I was trying to remember the movie closest to something like the 7-Ups, like in recent years. Mm. Best thing I could come up with, and this is sad, Chuck Norris's Code of Silence from like 1985.
Directed by Andrew Davis.
Who has, I think his style was very inspired by this trilogy of films. And, that urban reality vibe. And
today our car chase movies are Fast and Furious, which I like those movies. I do. Yeah. I like the Fast and Furious movies.
No, that's fine.
Good. I like them, but they're comic books.
But exactly. They're so over the top. Like, you know, they're just, you know, you don't get the visceral intensity that you get in this movie. Like the little things, like the car getting in front of the bus and the guy pulling out the sawed off shotgun and shooting the hood off. Like that moment is so it just feels real.
Mm.
You know, the way the Fast and the Furious movies don't. And you know, those are awesome movies for what they are, but they go in the same camp as like Marvel films, you know.
Mm.
But they're I think they're better than most Marvel films.
You're not a big fan of the Ice Cube Torque movie?
What?
Torque?
Yeah. That movie is like a big joke. Like Joseph Kahn, I don't know.
I think Dave Windorf, the Monster Magnet guy who scored it, he said like the movie was intended to be a comedy.
Yeah, like he said, like because Joseph Kahn's a total hipster. Like he's a guy who, you know, likes to, you know, smarmily make fun of things. And you know, if you watched Detention, his hipster horror movie, it's very much the torque of horror films. You know,
yeah. Well, there's Rennie Harlan's Driven, which is unwatchable.
Yeah,
because it's got about 17 million edit points and it's edit cuts. It's just,
well, that's what kills a lot of car chase movies is too much editing.
No, this is not the car chase. I'm talking about just the whole movie is so kinetic. It's just like,
it's a racing movie, but you know, it's anything like it's too much editing. Like, you know, the car chase in The Rock's not that great. The camera's
awful.
The camera's moving around too much. Michael Bay's just like shooting and cutting, like he doesn't really know what he's doing. Mm. The car chase in Bad Boys 2 is better, but it was sort of indicative of a bad place car chase movies were going to, which was tons of CGI, stylish cutting. Like it just it emphasizes style over viscera. You know,
it's a filmmaking trend, and this is the problem. After I watched this, I said, this is my problem, is they don't make movies like this anymore. That's why I just don't go to the movies very much.
Well, Death Proof was an attempt at it, but...
Death Proof was trying to get back to that.
I like Death Proof,
I do like Death Proof.
Yeah, I do.
I have issues with it, but the car chase in it, nothing wrong with it. It's perfect.
No, it's good.
I think Death Proof is pretty bad. The car chase is good. It's not great. It's not as great as they hyped it up to be.
Tarantino definitely overhyped it. I mean, that's him, though. Anyway, he's going to do that. But, yeah.
I know. The thing is, when I went to see it, everybody was telling me how terrible it was. And when I saw the car chase, I was like, well, that was fucking awesome. You know, but, you know, there was something like Tarantino likes to pretend his movies are film criticism now. You know, he's almost like Jean-Luc Godard, but more watchable now, where he was making commentary on the group, you know, in Death Proof that get killed by stuntman Mike versus the girls that don't, which the girls that don't talk like Tarantino does. They talk about movies and stuff instead of boys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, what else did you take away from 7-Ups?
Mm-hmm.
It's the problem with this film is because you've got to see it more than once.
It's
a tough watch to follow the first time through.
But the thing is, the way I know it works is that I was engaged during the scenes, like the suspense and the car chases. Whereas if I really was totally disengaged, I wouldn't have been, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, I just need to watch this again because I didn't quite catch all the ins and outs. It reminded me of watching some of Michael Mann's movies, where some of his movies, I have trouble following them. And then the second time I watch them, I go, oh, okay, you know, I kind of get it now.
What it felt like to me was, if it wasn't for the car chase, if that was not an error, or if there was a car chase and it was very minimal, this would have been a really, really good TV movie or a pilot to a TV series.
Mm.
That's what it felt like, whereas French Connection doesn't feel like a pilot. It feels like a film. Bullet feels like a film, whereas 7-Ups feels like a very expensive TV pilot. for. I mean, there's no reason why. Actually, this really could have been a series of 13 episodes.
Well, right? And what's it's funny you say that because D'Antoni got into television after this.
Okay.
Like, I think he only did television after this. Mm. But I did think it felt like a film. I didn't think it felt like television. And
No, and I'll tell you why, because television didn't look like this in 73.
Yeah, yeah, that's the thing. Is
if you look at Starsky and Hutch, where they're trying to do like a 7-Ups type thing on TV, it looks like a TV show shot in L.A. It's just got that cliched Aaron Spelling production look.
Aaron Spelling, yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Aaron Spelling was like, owned television for a while.
Oh,
like,
yo, no,
TV,
that,
TV did not get visually interesting until Twin Peaks.
Well, it was visually interesting. There were.
I'm saying like, okay, after the 60s where TV shows look great, mm-hmm. and then Kung Fu looks unique for a yeah. Western when nobody else was doing Westerns mm-hmm. at the time on TV.
Miami
and then,
Vice.
But then when you get it, yeah, and then when you get to 80s, you get Miami Vice with the MTV look. But looking at that now, it doesn't really hold up as anything unique.
But like you look at a lot of other Asian shows, they look like shit. You know,
yeah.
You don't like you don't like the Miami Vice episode where they're, Crockett and Tubbs are dealing with the Haitian zombies. Oh come on, seriously.
No, I haven't seen that.
Oh, that's a good one. That one, yeah.
I did watch some episodes of Miami Vice recently, and I was struck by how much better it looks than other shows from the era.
Oh man,
like the Fall Guy.
That first two part of that Calderon's Return.
Oh yeah.
That if that had been stitched together as a film released theatrically, nothing wrong with it.
No, nothing wrong with it. In fact,
I think it was in some countries.
It's even got like the great soundtrack. It's got the Phil Collins music and you know, all the Peter Gay. It's just so good. Like
that's why we watched it. Like that and the other Michael Mann production Crime Story were like I was into them because they look like movies. They were look closer. Like Miami Vice looked like Scarface. Crime Story looked like a 60s gangster film.
Yeah.
80s sheen or whatever. But they were visually, they were trying for a different look. Where if you look at other action series like The Fall Guy or Magnum P.I., they all have kind of the same drab look to them.
I do. Mm-hmm.
Flat staging and everything else.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Airwolf. You know, it doesn't matter what it is.
Airwolf.
It all kind of looks the same, you know.
Jag.
But then with like Twin Peaks and then X-Files and Homicide: Life on the Street, you started getting this more visually interesting, consistent TV shows for especially cops. Now they all look like that, though. Like Bones looks just like Numbers, which looks just like CSI.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And NCIS. Like they all look the same now. So
they
now
look like Dexter, and Dexter's.
By the way, I love what was it? Homicide: Life on the Street. Whit Stillman directed some episodes of that. Mm-hmm. And he was really upset because he felt the movies were unfair towards. He thought they were too liberal.
Yeah.
Whit Stillman, like I love Whit Stillman because he makes these sort of like J.D. Salinger-esque movies mm-hmm. that really appeal to critics, but he's super right wing.
Yeah.
He was like, Homicide: Life on the Street. He was like, this show is just way too liberal. But it's just funny because I don't know. Just when you watch Whit Stillman's movies, you wouldn't think the guy's super conservative, but he is.
No, I remember seeing Last Days of Disco, and I have no idea.
Yeah, Metropolitan's great. I love that movie. I
haven't seen it.
Oh, it's so funny. It feels like Catcher in the Rye or something like that. Like,
right. Well, the thing is, like, okay, 7-Ups has this kind of gritty street look that it's kind of carried on in other movies of the 70s, and it's common with Superfly and like a lot of these other like, you know, urban crime flicks and everything is like they all have that. Let's not shoot on sets. Let's, you know, shoot real locations. Let's do all on location in New York. Let's not shoot this in L.A. or Toronto mm-hmm. and try to pass it off, which is something that happened in the 80s and 90s.
Mean Streets was shot in L.A. Most people don't know.
Yeah, I didn't even realize that.
No,
I haven't seen it in years. But
yeah, some exteriors were shot in New York. Most of the movie was shot in L.A.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like that's kind of – that's something missing today is that type of regional appeal or you know, just that flavor of being in a different part of the country besides Los Angeles.
Well, and that's what's funny is, you know, you do get the occasional movie that's made in, you know – Louisiana or Georgia for monetary purposes. New Mexico is another one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it almost feels like the only regional ones you get like are it's because of it's cheap to shoot there.
Tax incentives.
You know, I used to deal with all that stuff. you want to go on Netflix, there's a movie called Losers Take All that I worked on that my name's actually in the credits for. That was made in Memphis about 80s punk rockers. But, you know, it was a movie that was made in Memphis because it was just, in theory, cheaper to shoot there.
Hey, man, that was part of a mumblecore film. What have
it was,
you done?
It's not a mumblecore film. It's not a mumblecore film.
Oh, gee, he was quick to disparage that one, wasn't he?
No. it's totally. I've definitely. Hey, Stuart, you've loved some Memphis mumblecores.
Yes, I have. I'm only kidding. Yeah.
Well, absolutely. See, the Schwarzenegger film Sabotage last year, which is not very like Seven Ups because it's very into the fantasy action realm.
And it's fantasy action meets like slasher horror.
Yeah,
like,
but here's the thing. It was set in Atlanta where it was filmed.
Oh.
Yeah.
They actually set it there, so I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, well, like, it was just weird, like, this movie I made, like, it was interesting to see, not that I made, that I worked on, sorry. Mm-hmm. People often say made to things they worked on. Right. This movie that I worked on, it,
Yeah, who are you, Ed Norton?
Yeah. Yes, guys, we get to work on.
Did you ever hear his commentary on Fight Club? It's hilarious. When I was working on the script, I mean, when we were working on the script, yeah. So, and he's nowhere in the writing credits, by the way.
Yeah, he's one of those act like if you watch Birdman, Norton is very much.
I won't. Don't worry.
Norton is playing his reputation.
Wow.
The guy who comes in, takes over the script, takes over everything.
Like he
well,
did.
Now he does Anchor Bay movies, so kind of.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's funny. His character talks about like because Keaton's character is doing a Raymond Carver play, mm-hmm. And if you read the Raymond Carver story, the dialogue in the play is pretty much as the story goes, mm-hmm. And Norton's character is like, you know, we need to make it like Carver. You know, Carver left a piece of his liver on the table every time he wrote. And he'll run lines with Keaton, and Keaton will do lines, and he'll go, no, that's too redundant. You need to just say this. But he's changing Carver's words. Like, if you read the story.
Right.
But it's very much Norton playing his own reputation.
Yeah. So would you recommend this Birdman movie?
You know, I did think it was because I like Michael Keaton. Mm-hmm. So I did enjoy it as a Keaton fan, but I thought Inarritu was jacking off with the camera a lot, which kind of annoyed me. Like, it's a lot of single takes. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of following the camera around and a lot of fireworks and, you know, hoo-ah and all that with his directing style. And I think it does the movie a disservice. Mm-hmm. But I thought the performances were fantastic, and I was really into what the actors were doing. But I just thought the director was showing off too much.
I was just thinking, how come nobody's cast Michael Keaton as like a new Popeye Doyle?
Yeah, Keaton's great. Like, was it Carolla did this bit about how he always has this thing about how Katy Perry always looks like she's thinking about something stupid. Mm-hmm. He said Keaton always looks like he's thinking about something really intense.
No. Katy Perry's thinking because she actually is stupid, and she actually looks stupid because she's trying to think of something.
But, like, Keaton's eyebrows and everything, it just always looks like he's having super intense thoughts.
All right. Yeah. Real quick, favorite Michael Keaton film. Go. Hannah.
Night Shift.
Yay. Got it. Were you guessing or were you actually saying your favorite was Night Shift?
Night Shift was the first one that popped into my head, so I'm going for that.
Excellent. Right, good answer, actually. This is my answer to Night Shift by a mile. Still my favorite. Yeah. John?
Dream Team.
Oh, Jesus Christ. With, where he plays the fake psychiatrist, right? The guy who busts out of the mental institution?
Yeah, he plays a crazy guy.
I saw it at the fucking drive-in. That was actually really funny.
Holy shit.
I've never seen that. Fucking forgot all about that movie.
Really good movie.
Man.
Very underappreciated.
And with Jeffrey Tambor, was he in it? Or was it? No, Peter Boyle.
Peter Boyle was in it. Christopher Lloyd, I think, was in it. Yep. I haven't seen it since I saw it in the theater, but I thought it was hilarious.
It was a very funny movie.
Christopher Lloyd, Peter Boyle, and Stephen Furst.
I don't even think it's on video.
Lorraine Bracco.
Yeah. That sounds right. Yeah.
Oh, I gotta see this.
It's really funny, actually. I really enjoyed it. Yeah. The Couch Trip with Dan Aykroyd. That was
never
the other
saw
one.
That.
No, we never saw that. That was the one where he played like a mental institution, mental patient who breaks out. It was like the you know, like a mini slew of those movies throughout the late 80s, early 90s, mental patient movies.
I've heard Game 6 is really good, one with him.
I haven't seen it. But yeah, Dream Team was very good. I saw that. Yeah, I saw that.
I need to see that. I also liked him in Jackie Brown a lot. That was a good one.
True. Check out Couch Trip as well with Dan Aykroyd. That was quite funny. I enjoyed that one. If you can find it, good luck. It may be on YouTube. Someone's uploaded the video there, because I don't think you've ever seen a DVD version of it anywhere. That's for sure.
Jesus Christ, he was in a fucking...
Apparently there was a DVD of Dream Team. I don't know if it's still available, but...
It's probably here on us. It's probably in JB for like $5.99.
Yeah, James Remar is...
Oh, God. Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Another underappreciated actor that I'm a fan of.
Very good. Very good actor. All right, anything else that you want to say about 7-Ups? What we're going to give this as a rating?
I give it a 9.
Wow. Okay.
I'm going strong.
That's a fair...
I'll come out swinging. Because I could watch it again. I could watch it again tonight, no problem.
Yeah, I could watch it again, too.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, I plan on watching it again.
Yeah. If I want to show somebody a great car chase, I'm going to show them this movie.
Absolutely. I was going to post the car chase on Facebook. I was just going
to there's plenty of links to that. On YouTube.
And the way it ends is just so like, oh.
It is. It, yeah.
You go,
Well, there you go. The Dream Team's available on, sorry to divert away from 7-Up, Dream Team's available on iTunes, people, in HD for $15 to buy.
Fuck yeah, I'm going to go watch that.
And so is The Couch Trip as well, it looks like. $17.99 in HD. So, that's cool. Oh, this is the Australian store, so it's probably like $5.99 in the US. Ignore those prices, that's the Australian store. Oh, John, here's another one of mental patients breaking out of the asylum. Remember Loose Cannons?
I never saw it, but I do remember the
Yeah, games. Gene Hackman and was it Rick Moranis? No, Dan Aykroyd. There's another one.
Yeah, it was Dan Aykroyd. I think it was designed as like originally pitched as a sequel to some popular movie.
Right.
Bob Clark. It was supposed to be a sequel to which one?
It's a Bob Clark film as well, Porky's Bob Clark.
Right, it was actually a refitted sequel to something to become an original movie.
Oh. Nice.
Like it, but I forget what it was. I just read it the other day and I was like, oh my God, really?
Oh, and it's produced by our friend of the show, Aaron Spelling, it says here. There you go.
Aaron Spelling's fucking dead. He's not producing shit.
Worst production Aaron Spelling ever did was Tory. Yeah, shame much. Alright, Hunter, will you give this out of 10?
I give it an 8.
Alright, I need to give this probably like a 3, I'd say, out of 10. Nah, I'm joking. I sort of raised the ire of John there for a second, but it didn't work.
I give it an 8 for the same reason. I was thinking a 7, but when John said I'd watch it again, I was like, you know what? That's a really good statement, because I would watch it again, like,
exactly.
After we recorded this. I'd pop it in again. Yeah. Like, and just because it is a movie that demands another watch, and you can tell when you see it, it's compelling enough.
Yep. I'm going to give this an 8 also. I really enjoyed it, but yes, it does need a second viewing to soak up more of the story. But it was strong enough the first time around, or second time around, because it's been many years since I last seen it, to warrant another viewing in the very near future, definitely. All right, so that's 7-Ups. It's a Cliff Notes version of 7-Ups. It's, like we said, it's...
Word.
Yeah, does need to be seen and seen a couple of times, but don't let it put you off. I would say also, don't just watch the car chase and dismiss the film, because there's a lot more to the film than just the car chase.
There is, and you know, a lot of the you have to be invested in the car chase. Like, the car chase is way cool, you have to be a little bit invested in it, and there's enough in the first viewing that I was latching onto where I was invested. It's just, with the first viewing, I didn't quite know who's in, who's out, who's this, who's that. I know this guy's a cop. Okay, I know this guy's this. But there were a few gray areas where I wasn't quite sure.
And the thing is, you're invested with these characters by the time the car chase hits in about the 50s.
Exactly. Like, when the car chase hits, I was like, I was gripping the seat. You know, I was way into it.
Yeah, it wasn't like
acting on the couch.
It wasn't like they pulled a Mad Max and threw it at the start to get your attention. And then, because it would have dropped off. But,
right.
And that's where Mad Max suffers a bit as well. It drops off a bit after that car chase.
That is where Mad Max... As much as I'd hate to point out that Mad Max has any flaws, that is a flaw with that movie.
Oh, absolutely it is, yeah. I mean, they fixed it all in the Road Warrior, I mean, you know, Mad Max 2, but... You know.
I mean, and we all know that the best movie of 2015 is going to be Fury Road. I mean, no question.
It's not going to work.
I saw another trailer for it, and I'm like, I can't wait.
I don't know how many trailers are going to release. I mean, really, it's about, what,
I'm so fucking stoked. I can't wait.
That's all right. You do a show with Garrow on it. He can fill in for me
we'll
that week.
We'll do a show with Garrow on it, and it'll just be a making fun of Stu show.
Which is always it is when I'm not here anyway, so there's no real difference.
It's true.
Yeah.
I had a guy come into Movie Trading Company, and he was asking, he needed a movie for a party, and he wanted one that would be perfect for making fun of his Australian friends.
Stork.
he wanted one to troll Australian people with.
Barry McKenzie, you know, holds his own.
I was like, you want to piss off your Australian friends, do you?
Yeah. Let me call Stuart up for a second. Let me speak to the master about it.
Too bad Fury Road's not on DVD right now.
God. I'm seriously, don't even.
I'm already calling it. It's going to be the dawn of the Planet of the Apes of this summer. It's going to be great.
Don't even ask me to do it. Don't bother.
It's gonna happen. Just, like, we're gonna.
Oh, you can do it by all means. You guys run off and watch your little Mad Max 4. I don't give a rat's ass. But don't beg me to do it, because you'll just be no.
Oh my gosh!
I'm washing my hair that day.
So good. It's gonna be so good.
Yes.
Can't wait.
All right. Anything else you want to bring up? No, you've ruined my day. You ruined my day. John ruined my day earlier with that horrible tidbit about Michael Jackson, which will never be repeated.
No.
Fuck no way.
I've already scrubbed it from my brain. I don't want it.
Yeah.
Think of already.
Oh, okay. Okay, I actually just I actually looked into what Loose Cannons was originally intended to... What it was written by Richard Matheson to be a sequel to.
Right.
Cobra, the Stallone movie.
You're joking.
No.
Oh, I gotta let Craig and the guys at Slycast know about that one. That is insane.
It was revised beyond all recognition by director Bob Clark into a critically reviled buddy cop.
Oh, yeah. Bob Clark did not.
That's what this blog says that I found out. It's about Richard Matheson's writing.
Bob Clark has, oh, like, he has a handful of, like, beloved movies.
Yeah.
And, like, a dump truck full of reviled
baby geniuses, yeah.
Baby Geniuses 2, Karate Dog.
Oh. He did Karate Dog?
Yes, he did.
And he did one of the best Jack the Ripper movies I've seen, I think, ever. The
Murder by Death?
Murder by Decree. Which I've known it as. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, Murder by Decree, that's what it is.
Yeah,
my favorite
great
Jack the
movies.
Ripper movie, and the most realistic, I think, is Time After Time.
That one was actually good fun. I enjoyed that.
I love Time After
With Malcolm
Time.
McDowell, right?
I was just acting like it was realistic. But yeah, it's awesome. I love it.
Mm. My favorite is the movie that Murder by Decree kind of ripped off, which was Study in Terror.
Okay.
It's a Sherlock Holmes versus Jack the Ripper movie from like the early 60s.
I'm sure.
Oh, jeez. That sounds like good.
It's really good. It's not on DVD in America. I had to order it from England, but it's a pretty cool flick.
Mm. Something tells me that's what... Nicholas Meyer was going for, because he's such a Sherlock Holmes.
Well, it actually started the whole Royals conspiracy theory stuff that Alan Moore's ripped off for his comic book that became that lousy movie, and just about everything else. It had the whole conspiracy, and I think it tied in with the Masons and stuff. It was crazy.
Alan Moore, God, there's an entity unto himself.
Hunter
is the best Alan Moore. Hollywood never got any of my movies right.
Never got my movies right. I just want them to take to task Margaret Thatcher for ruining this country.
look at me beard. I'm so eccentric.
By the way, Frank Miller, he doesn't like my work. Well, look at his. He's so right-wing and angry.
This coming from an old mystical shaman.
By the way, here's one of my medals. I worship the snakes Jesus set.
Jesus Christ. Alan Moore. He's like one of those old rabbis you find with fucking chicken soup in his beard, you know. Scare the kids away at the synagogue.
Excuse me, I gotta go write some pornographic comic books about a female fairy tale characters with me wife.
I'm gonna go write a really deep Swamp Thing story.
Oi.
To me, it was just a Steve Gerber ripoff with a British accent. That's all he was.
And oh, and beard. Fuck Dave Gibbons while you're at it as well.
Yeah.
All right.
He put his name on the Watchmen movies so he can suck me cock, if, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And me cock looks like a metal snake that I worship. In fact, I worship my own cock.
Me cock has fangs.
Oh, God. All right, all right.
Boy, yeah. This week at Hunter Looks at the Movies.
Wow.
We've got Whiplash with J.K. Simmons.
Wow. That sexy British accent of yours. It must have been all those all that time you spent away from America over in England, right?
Oi, this week on Hunter Looks at the Movies, we've got Selma.
Can I help you out? Can I help racist. You out and say that nobody says oi anywhere in the world? Oi. They don't say oi. It there and they don't say it here either.
Oi.
Oi.
They say it on Hunter Looks at the Movies.
and Hunter will also be reviewing Myra Breckinridge. There you go.
We're going to talk about Selma and the Oscars institutional racism here on Hunter Looks at the Movies.
Yes, and while we're at talking about Selma, we're going to talk about pissed off Negroes. Upset about.
And excuse me while I read a passage from Jim Goad's seminal article, I'm So Bored with MLK.
Wasn't that a song by The Clash?
Yeah. He wrote an article called I'm So Bored with MLK. I'm so bored with the USA. Yeah. So bored with
MLK. That needs to be a Clash parody. I'm so bored with MLK. I smear the blood of MLK on my sweater.
Oh, God, Stu went there, not me.
Jesse Jackson, he went smeared his blood all over his sweater. Oh, I can't fool.
And then in 2 weeks, we review, at least Stuart does a solo show reviewing a screwdriver movie. There we go.
We're going to review the Huey P. Newton story. Talking about how good it is.
The George Wallace story.
The Daniel Carver story.
Ah, fuck it. We're just going to do Black Dynamite.
Yeah, probably. We should. It's great.
By the way, I've got to say...
You get away from him, you moon cricket!
By the way, I've got to say, I did watch Black Dynamite again. I actually enjoyed the film a bit more than I did the first time around. But I watched the animated series season one. Holy shit, funniest thing I've seen in fucking years. Funniest shit. Oh, God, John.
I've heard the show is fucking great.
Oh, I'm not
watching. Is it on Hulu?
You can look, but check it out. You are going to bust your ass laughing. It is so much funnier than the movie ever was. It's like
the movie was really funny.
So. The film's funny. No, the film is very good, but it's dry in parts. The TV show just goes off the fucking hook. It's that funny.
Your name's Black Dynamite? My dad's name is Black Dynamite. My dad's name is Black Dynamite, too. My dad's name is Black Dynamite, too. Chill out, kids. Lots of brothers got that name.
The first episode of Black Dynamite, the animated series, where he's trapped in Neverland by Michael Jackson, fucking crying. I was crying with laughter. Was that funny? Where Jackson's actually an alien from another race. He's not a real person.
I think the reason Stu loves it is just come to light.
Oh, man. It is... Michael Jai White and all the others affiliated with that show just fucking went as far as they possibly could go with that show. It is so funny. Yeah. They make fun of everyone. OJ. when Black Dynamite and OJ are meant to go to the moon together. And OJ actually runs out of the ship at the last minute and they just send Black Dynamite. It's fucking hysterical. It really is the funniest shit I've seen in ages. I can't encourage people enough to check out the Black Dynamite animated series. And number two is either coming out or it's already airing in the US.
I'm going to have to check it out.
Cannot fucking wait. Cannot wait. You've got to watch it. Oh, man. I was dying. And it takes a lot to make me laugh because I'm a miserable sod, but I was fucking dying watching that show. Was that funny? Every episode, like the 10 episodes, every one of them, kicking goals. Just hysterical, all of them. Every one of them. Mr. T, when they go to the jungle and they encounter Mr. T, it's just, and they poke fun at whites, blacks, everybody in that show. No one's sacred. So, Hannah, really, you got to watch the episode where they rip into Elvis, and they rip into Elvis, and they do the whole version of All Shook Up, but they call it All Fucked Up. Just about the song's all lyrics about Elvis popping pills. It's like, I'm all fucked up. And you've got to watch that show. Everybody listening, fucking watch Black Dynamite TV series. It'll kill you. It's that funny. I promise me it is that funny. Oh, heavens. All right, let's wrap it up this week. Next week, we are going to be reviewing...
Rude Boy.
Rude Boy by The Clash. That's right.
Yeah.
Yes, that's. I just watched it again the other night on the big screen for the first time on the big screen, and I'll watch it again as well before we talk about it. And
Police at the eaves in the streets.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
You know, competition. There was the Blondie. They went disco. The Talking Heads are all odd. The Clash, they went all reggae. So there was just us, the Ramones.
Yeah. And on that, we'll say goodbye. So, sign off, lads.
Adios!
Mahalo!
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast. To leave feedback and show suggestions, email us at midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like our Midnight Movie Cowboys show page on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and feel free to leave us a review. Listen to us on Stitcher.com or the Stitcher Radio app. Want to help the show out? Visit MidnightMovieCowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate link. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Our personal links are on the right side of our homepage. See y'all next time.
Interior.